had a vision. I had an honest to God vision. I'm not talking metaphorically. I had a vision in which I saw my life pass before me like a circus train. And each car was painted as a different career that I had in my life. And they went by, you know, the computer person, the performance person, all of those things, the recording engineer, the fiction writer, on and on. And when the caboose went by, there was a clown standing on the little platform on the back of the caboose with a red nose. And as that went by, the clown waved at me. And I waved back and I said, bye-bye. Bye-bye to my previous life. This is my new life now. And the train went off into the distance and disappeared. And I was an academic. That was my moment. And I never looked back.
Sandy Stone describes herself as a narrator, a shameless teller of stories, and she certainly has some tales worth telling. Sandy joins John and Scoop for a wide-ranging chat about her work as a recording engineer, academic theorist, and new media champion.
Welcome to the Plecopia Podcast. I hope everybody's doing well and staying safe. Today, we're going to talk to Sandy Stone. Sandy's a cultural theoretician, audio engineer, computer hacker, filmmaker, and performance artist. She's the founding director of the Advanced Communication Technologies Laboratory, or ACT Lab, at the University of Texas at Austin, which is how Sandy and I met through her move to Austin to be part of ACT Lab. And then she's also a fellow of the University of California Humanities Research Institute, a founder of the academic discipline of transgender studies, a recipient of the State of California Lifetime Achievement Award. And she's been interviewed in various publications like Art Forum, Wired, Mondo 2000, where you were interviewed by some stellar people, as I recall, Paco and I, and Dave Damaris. Also, Gender Knots, et cetera. And Sandy is someone that I've described as a force of nature. And we're very happy to have you here with us today. And now you're living in Santa Cruz, right?
I'm living in Santa Cruz, right, for now. I still feel like a native Austinian, but I'm also a native Californian and a native New Yorker, which is kind of weird, but there you are.
Well, Austin's kind of a moving target. It's changed since you were last here, actually. It keeps changing. And more recently, Elon Musk moved here. And Oracle is moving its headquarters here. So it's like we're the big city now.
You got one of the good guys, or relatively, you know, one of the bad guys, relatively.
There you go, yeah. So I guess we should start by talking about your history. You started your first career was as a recording engineer, and eventually you left that and became an academic. And I know there's a long story there, but let's tell that story. How did you get from one place to the other?
Well, my first career was actually as a research assistant at Bell Telephone Labs, but that didn't work out for me. I wasn't meant for research as a career. So eventually I wound up as a sound engineer, which started because I couldn't stop building audio equipment. And eventually I wound up, I got into professional recording by walking into a recording studio in New York and telling them I was the greatest recording engineer in the world. And I'd never had a job in real recording before in my life. So this was kind of a stretch. And they gave me the reception I deserved. And then Gary Kellgren said, "We're really looking for somebody who can fix stuff. Can you fix stuff?" And, you know, the one big lie deserves another. I said, sure, I can fix anything. So they dragged me back into the control room where they had an old Scully, not an old Scully, it's old now, but at that time it was state-of-the-art Scully 12-track recorder. It was the only 12-track recorder Scully had ever made. And this is before 16-track came along. God, I haven't talked about this stuff in so long, it takes me a while to remember all the names. Anyway, they let me look at this machine, and I said, as you might expect, oh, fix a bunch of those. Just let me read the instruction manual and make sure I know which model this is. And they handed me the instruction manual. You know, it was like giving me a license to kill. And I speed read the instruction manual while they stood there. And then I put my hands on the machine. And lo and behold, it started to work. And they hired me on the spot as a maintenance person. And then it turned out I was their only maintenance person. So there I was, you know, keeping all the machines in the record plant running. And at that point, they'd been doing it on a basis of whoever is at the board, when something breaks, they hit it until it works. Or they call, you know, Scully or Ampex or whoever made the machine and ask for a new one. It was that kind of a time. So here I was, and I would make things work. And I hung around in the control room, sort of lurking in the shadows for 3 weeks, I believe it was. And at the end of 3 weeks, you know, and I'd been sleeping in the studio. I didn't have any place to live in New York. So they had a freight elevator down to their basement, and they were storing Jimi Hendrix's tour stuff down there. And one of the piles of tour stuff was a pile of costumes and capes. And Jimmy owned a lot of capes, so it was very soft. And I slept on that. And then in the morning, I'd struggle up to the control room and fix stuff until the session started later in the day. And then I'd hang around in the control room and watch what they were doing. And after 3 weeks of that, Tony Bon Jovi turned around to me and said, kid, I'm not feeling very well. You got to take over this date. He was doing Jimi Hendrix at the time. And it was, you know, it's like this black and white B movie thing. Kid, you got to do this. You know, the plane is in a spiral. And, you know, so I sat down at the controls and did the date. And there was something about my not having any investment in the glitz of the thing. I just wanted to get the music right. And Jimmy picked up on that right away. And he liked what I did. So he asked for me again. And that led to a little disagreement here and there. And the truth is, Record Plant was right. They didn't need another engineer. You could get engineers for, you know, for pennies. You open the door and say, can you turn knobs? You know, somebody would show up. What they really needed was somebody who knew how the equipment worked, which the engineers really did not. And I did. So they wanted me to keep fixing things. And I said, okay, as long as I go on fixing things, can I engineer? And they said, yeah. So I became Jimmy's engineer, and I went on engineering him for a fair while. We did almost all of what are called the basement tapes, basement tapes or somebody else. We did almost all the warehouse tapes, and we did a number of the good takes on a number of his albums, and don't ask me what they're, I don't keep track of that stuff. I have a CD around somewhere that a Hendrix scholar sent me that has all the tracks on it that I engineered, but I don't, you know, it's not on my wall. I don't look at it.
What was it like working with Jimi Hendrix? I mean, what was he like?
He was a perfectionist par excellence. He was compulsively critical and careful about his music. And he was a sweet guy with a big heart. And he was surrounded by people who just wanted to pull off little pieces of him and eat them.
Energy creatures.
Yeah. And that led to eventually killed him. But in the meantime, it cost him a tremendous amount of energy. And I kind of, a couple of times I went into mother hen mode and tried to protect him from his own entourage, which is really, you know, tricky and uncalled for. And I probably shouldn't have done it. And at one point, Jimmy would frequently come in with this long line of people who were partying and yelling and mainly yelling, you know, yelling, shouting to each other, telling jokes, having a party in the control room while Jimmy was out in the studio with a soundproof wall between so he couldn't hear what they were doing. And he and I are trying to work. And there's this raucous, wild thing going on around me. And every once in a while I would yell, all right, everybody shut up. And if they could hear me over the noise, they would sometimes quiet down for a little while. But then I got to the point where it was interfering with what Jimmy was doing. It started to interfere with his work. And at one point I went out, I don't remember what we were putting Overdubs on another version of Stone Free. And I went out into the room and I'm going to talk to Jimmy and I can see that he's in there. We have really, this is an old style studio, relatively speaking. So we've got enormously thick doors with lead sheeting on them and, you know, heavy double glass panes. So I can see him. I can see him fingering and strumming the guitar, and I can hear vaguely the Marshall stack going on in the background. And I open the door, and it's like, you know, this wall comes at him and hits me. And I walk toward him. It's like walking through butter. The sound is so loud. It's a physical presence in the room. And he's just standing there with his tongue in the corner of his mouth like that. Just playing, leaning against the Marshall stack, which is the point at which I realized he was probably deaf. You know, and he was partially deaf. A lot of the heavy musicians at that point were partially deaf.
Jimmy had a reputation for experimentation, very, you know, exotic stuff, you know, recording tracks and then playing and then putting them in the mix backward, that kind of thing. Did you experience anything with him along the level of that kind of experimentation?
Yes, I did. Jimmy could hear things that wouldn't be possible until digital came along a few years later. Rick Factor, who started a company called Eventide Clockworks, had his original studio about two blocks away. And he was designing what would later be equipment that Jimmy would use, but didn't exist at that time. So for instance, I mean, there was a lot of it, but one of the things Jimmy wanted was digital delay. I mean, you could do analog delay. You could get a standard 10th of a second delay out of a machine. But Jimmy was hearing delays that were short enough that you would start to get comb filtering from the interference between the two sounds. And he could hear that in his head. And he wanted me to realize it on a physical machine. And we didn't yet have the digital ability to do that. So what I did instead was wind magnetic tape around the capstan head to build it up from its 3/8 inch diameter or so, up to about 2 inches, and then put a variable frequency oscillator and an amplifier on the capstan motor, which was a synchronous motor, which is to say it kept speed with the frequency that you put into it. So by varying the frequency of that motor, I could produce a tape delay, which was actually, you know, we're talking about a millisecond, something like that. I was trying to do better, but then you get into problems with the entire tape transport, which can't handle tape moving that fast anymore. We were doing, I think at that point we were doing about 80 inches per second, maybe, you know, trying for 100, which was about what RCA did with its adapted machines for their initial experiments in making video machines before the quadrature head system was developed. So that we were doing that kind of thing. Jimmy and I were doing that kind of thing in the studio. We did other tricks too. There was some backward stuff. You know, there were other things that we threw in here and there. But the main one that took time and work was trying to get comb filter effects with the human voice by means of ultra speed mechanical delay. So there's your, you know, for what that's worth, there it is.
Well, that's a great way to create music. I've worked in studios with, you know, in a previous life, and I would encounter studio people who would hate that kind of thing. I mean, you know, we don't do it that way. Yeah. And that I would just lose it because, you know, just because you don't do it that way, someone else might have a great idea. And it's great to have an engineer, from what I understand, you were one of those that would put up with it and go with it and develop the experimentation.
Well, there were plenty of the kind you're talking about around in New York at that point. We called them pocket protector people. Record Plant at that time was the only studio in New York with black lights in the control room. You know, we were the place to go if you wanted what would now be the normal vibe in a recording studio. The other guys were all, you know, these big cubicle spaces with fluorescent lighting in the ceiling, and the engineers in white shirts and ties and pocket protectors. And, you know, and here we were, dirty, grubby, wearing weird, outlandish, flashy clothing, Nehru suits, the bells, and you know, on and on like that. And the consoles were glowing because we had had them specially painted with fluorescent paint rubbed into the engravings. And, you know, the whole scene was really very weird. You know, so that it helped a little if you were stoned when you went in there. It made more sense.
But and you were probably never stoned, right? You were probably never stoned, right?
Well, you can't mix stoned. You can record stoned. And it was almost impossible not to be. when Nick Vinay was working a date there, whoever Nick was working with at the time, Nick had, many of these people had personal dealers, and Nick had a particularly nice personal dealer named Tiny. A lot of the huge guys were named Tiny at that time. And Nick's dealer had a little of everything, and he would sit quietly smiling in the back. And Nick's chauffeur and bodyguard, who was this really sweet guy named Doc, came in one night, and he had had a terrible time trying to park the car, and he had a run-in with the cops, and it was theater time, and all the theaters were letting out, and the street was a mess, and he had this huge limousine to park. And when he came in, he was totally, you know, you could see he was just fried out of his mind. And Nick pointed to him and said, "Stone that man!" And his dealer got up with an enormous spliff, you know, and Doc immediately got nicely peaceful. And then he turned to me with a spliff, you know, what do you do in that moment? You know, I could say, thanks, I can't, I'm working. But I know this is some of the best dope in the world. And what are you going to do? So you do. And it was glorious. You know, it was great stuff. Everybody in there with a personal dealer, you know, sometimes the personal dealers would talk to each other and compare their wares. And we would get to be the beneficiaries of that. And usually when they left, they would leave me a little gift, you know, or a big gift. So some people whom I can't name, who were the heirs to a very, very large, well-known distillery who lived in a penthouse on the west side, invited me over one day with one of the gifts I had been given, which was a fist-sized lump of kief. And what I did was cook chicken with it. I made chicken kief. And it was fantastic. You know, it was great. And you would eat it and you would wind up on the floor unable to move. But it was wonderful.
Sounds amazing. Why did you ever leave New York?
For two reasons. One of them was it was getting to be too much for me. Because you know me, I am not by nature that kind of a high pressure person. And the other one was I started to bleed internally from the stress, and it took a long time to figure out that I was bleeding. And by that time I had lost over half my blood supply and was in dangerous territory. And when I got out, the doctor said, you gotta rest. So I decided to go out to California for, actually I didn't go to California, I went to Santa Fe, New Mexico for 2 weeks and came back and decided that maybe I should not go back to doing this. At that point, I was not working for Record Plant anymore. I had resigned from Record Plant over a fight with Gary Kellgren, who wanted me to. Gary had this wonderful idea, which he actually put into practice, of turning the Record Plant into a franchise. So we would have Record Plants in California, Record Plants in Illinois, Record Plants in Nashville, which happened after a while. But he wanted me to design and build them out. And I was this kid. I just said, I don't want to do that. I want to mix. I want to make music. This is for me. And it got, and at first Gary thought, you know, yeah, right, you'll get over that. And I never got over it. And gradually the plans began to develop with Anki Johnson and Chris Stone and Gary. They began to put together, because they had access to almost unlimited capital, they began to put together the outlines of their empire. And I wanted none of it. I just, you know, somebody would come in and I'd make friends with them. I just liked them, most of them. And, you know, we'd get to be friends and I'd enjoy making their music with them. And they liked working with someone who understood what they were up to and wasn't just pushing buttons and turning knobs. And I wanted to go on doing that. And Gary couldn't find anybody who could do what I could do with regard to building or fixing equipment. So we were at odds. And Gary finally one day kind of put his arm around me and said, kid, you're going to make a choice. You're either going to build our studios or I'm not going to let you mix anymore. And at that point, I had built out Record Plant Studio B in New York. And I was doing all the dates that I was doing, plus maintaining the studios and building their stuff because I could. And they needed somebody who could do that. And at that point, we had planned for a studio in Sausalito in LA. There was one kind of in the wind for Chicago and Nashville. And nothing was built, but the feelers were already out for real estate and that sort of thing. And I went home, and I had gone back to living at Blaker and McDougall, I think. Anyway, I went home, and I sat on the floor, and I thought, okay, you know, do I get on the money train now, or do I follow my heart? Because Gary was saying things like, I'm going to make you rich. You'll be able to retire on the money from this, build this chain, and, you know, you'll get a piece of the action on all of this, and we'll get you stock in Abaddon Corporation, and, you know, and I wound up writing a letter of resignation. I sneaked into the studio in the middle of the night, and I put it in Fern's drawer. Fern was our receptionist. And I left, and I never went back. I started doing other stuff in New York. And I began writing articles for a publication. And it was through that I got an invitation to go to the first alternative media conference that Larry Yerden and Lorenzo Milam put on in Brattleboro at Goddard College. So there's that.
So eventually you moved to California. Where did you land in California?
Well, I got to California by going to the alternative media conference, which for the first day was the first time a lot of those people had ever seen each other. We had people in alternative media from all over the United States and Canada and a few from south of the border, not too many. You know, it was primarily where Larry and Lorenzo traveled on their trips. So we had people from free radio. We had people from underground publications who knew there were other people out there but had never met them. And suddenly it was this moment that there was a community. We all had similar ideas, and the tremendous potential of what we could do together. Because no internet, you know, phones were very expensive. Basically, they were little isolated islands across the country. So there was this first day of tremendous connection and seminars and talks of what could be. And then on the second day, Holding Together showed up. Holding Together was the people, Tim Leary's wife and his attorney, and the people who were working to get Tim out of jail. Tim Leary, for you younger folks, was the person who popularized lysergic acid, diethylamide, sometimes known as LSD or acid, in the United States. And he had been put in prison by our wonderful government, and there were people working to get him out. That organization was called Holding Together, and they showed up at the conference with smiles on their faces and a large attache case full of orange sunshine, which was the best acid available in the United States at that time. So the second day of the conference was like another universe. It was not like the first one at all. And that's the way the rest of the conference went on. It was Acid City in some parallel realm of consciousness. And at some point in some day of that rainbow-hazed cloud, Larry Yerden stood up and said, anybody who wants to go to California, go to the parking lot and get on the bus. So there was a bus in the parking lot, and I grabbed my stuff out of my room. Took us all a while because we were stoned out of our minds. We got on the bus and went to I don't remember which airport it was, because I don't think Brattleboro had an airport from which you could fly across country. But Larry had chartered a Boeing 707 from United Airlines in the name of Goddard College. There's some debate about this. The official account is that he stole Goddard's credit card, but it's not clear that that's what happened. There are other versions that he called United Airlines and simply told them he was with Goddard College and they took his word for it. So anyway, we all got on the plane and we took off, and then there was a lot of magic with flying near a lightning storm as a light show, and the no smoking sign going out, and watching the mayhem that happened after that, because the people on the plane were some of Ram Dass's people and some of the hog farm people and some of the dead's entourage and me and Dr. Feelgood and that kind of thing. And we were playing games on the plane that nobody should ever play, like, you know, running back and forth to change the center of gravity, which the pilots did not like at all, and which we should never have been doing. And at any rate, 4 or 5 hours later, I am sitting on a curb in San Jose International Airport, or outside San Jose International Airport, coming down off heavy acid and God knows what else. I don't know anybody in California. One person, it turns out, a colleague of mine from college, lives in town. And I managed to navigate my way to a phone booth. Remember them? Remember phone booths? And there's a phone book. Remember phone books in this thing? And I open it up, and she's listed. And it's, I don't know, it's 8 a.m., something like that. And I call her, and she's home. And I kind of mumble this thing of, hi, remember me, I'm Sandy Soon, and I'm at the airport, and I'm stoned out of my mind, and do you mind coming down and picking me up? And she did, and she took me to two friends of hers who were somewhat of a similar mind, and I wound up pitching a tent in their backyard and living in the tent for a year, and that's how I came to California.
I got to know Larry Yerden myself when I moved out from Houston to Berkeley and worked in some projects with him. So he was a mixer of people. He seemed to have this talent for just finding people and convincing them to do outrageous stuff. He did that to me a number of times. But I heard about that conference when I was still working in commercial radio in Texas, and it sounded like, you know, that sounded interesting because, you know, Texas radio, commercial radio, was starting to smell kind of funny. It wasn't dead yet, but it was coughing up blood. So I knew that there was had to be some other way, and that's when I saw that things like Pacifica Radio and other independent radio was cropping up around the country. And that conference pretty much was the genesis for a lot of that.
It was, you could feel that happening. You could feel it in the air. You could feel the seeds being planted and the crystal growth beginning to develop. By the way, were you at the Houston station when the KKK bombed it?
Yes, I came in shortly after the second bombing, actually, and worked in the news. I became news director there for a year and a half or so with all the original people, Larry Lee and all of that bunch, who we all ended up in Berkeley finally, because Houston was not really receptive to public radio or weirdo radio such as us. But it was a great experience, and it was all generated by that same conference. All the people that, you know, started the KPFT were people who were either influenced by that conference or were there.
Mm-hmm. It was kind of the formal beginning of freeform radio. It was wonderful to watch what happened after that. You were there during a really interesting period of time, Scoop. You've lived through some stuff yourself. You should be being the person interviewed, not me.
I prefer to interview. The one thing I learned from that experience was the joy of putting a microphone in front of people who don't normally experience that, but have something interesting or meaningful or just fun to say. And that's something that you really couldn't get in commercial radio. You had sound bites and you had commercials and you really couldn't say anything strange. But in that radio environment, you do what you want to. And it's sad that that seems to have died down quite a lot because of just changing time, changing interest. But it was a great time to be alive.
Well, maybe on the radio it's died down, but on the internet, you know, it's like no holds barred.
It's raging away. Well, we try to keep it alive at the Squid here at KSQD in our quiet little way, but we're actually proving that you can still do it.
And I really want to talk about that too. But before we go there, I'm interested. I've always wondered about this, how you got from being that person to the academic that you became, you know, how you found your way into academia, because you're definitely not the typical academic, as we all learned.
There had been friends for years who were saying to me, Sandy, you need to be a professor. You need to get into academia. That's really where you'll feel at home. And I always looked at academia with a jaundiced eye. It looked like a stuffy place. And it looked like a place with too much intellectual activity and not enough meat. And okay, I eventually, after I went to California, I moved to Santa Cruz, and I kind of never left. But of course, as you know, I did leave because you and I got to meet and become good friends. But at the time, I did not expect to leave Santa Cruz. And I started a business in town, and in order to have income, I started a little business on our downtown mall, which you could do at the time without much money up front. And I was doing that, and one day a woman named Donna Haraway, who had heard about me through, I'm not exactly sure how she heard about me, but she asked if I would come and talk to her. She was working on an article about cyborgs, and she wanted to talk to me about what it was like to live between certain worlds, certain dimensions, and what it felt to move between subjectivities, if I can put it that way. And we had a conversation, and I liked her very much. And I went back to town, and that was the end of it. I just thought, that was nice. And then someone showed me a video Donna had made called Donna Haraway Reads National Geographic, which was made by the Deep Dish. It was distributed by Deep Dish. It's still around. It's aged kind of well over the years, although it's not as revolutionary as it once was, but it was revolutionary in its time. And Donna was a full-on academic, and here she was in the fake jungle with Tarzan and the apes, deconstructing everything. And that made me go, oh, that's interesting. And then months went by, and I ran my business, and I went to work with Olivia and Records and came back. And one day I was standing in line at Straw Hat Pizza with the woman who was the administrative associate. That was her official title. Secretary is the impolite title. And practically, she ran the department. I mean, the person who sat at the front desk was actually the person who kept History of Consciousness running, because she actually told all the other people wandering around in their heads what they should be doing at any given time.
And that was where, at Stanford? Was that at Stanford?
No, that was at the University of California.
Oh, University of California. Yeah. UC Santa Cruz.
Her name was Billy Harris, and I ran into her at a pizza joint, and she was looking worried. And I said, "What are you worried about?" And she said, "Do you know anyone who could be a mercenary TA?" I have no idea what that meant. A TA is a teaching assistant. You know, something a graduate student does. And the deal was that at that point, the University of California, Santa Cruz, was so small that they didn't have enough graduate students to do teaching assistant for all the courses they were giving. So they were beginning to look around in town to see if they could find academically minded people who would be willing to sign on to do this. You know, it was basically bottom of the food chain kind of thing. But it sounded like, oh, that's weird. So I said, "You're looking for people who can do teaching assistants? How about me?" And she said, "You? You know, what makes you think you can look like an academic?" And I said, "Well, what does it take to look like an academic?" And she said, "Come here." And we sat down at a table, and she wrote out on a paper napkin what I needed to do to look like an academic. And I did that, and they hired me. And
wait, how did you look, and how did she think you needed to look?
I needed to be able to talk academies, which involved a little less of my street speech patterns.
So it wasn't how you looked physically. It was more like just how you presented yourself.
I think so. I was not that much of a slob. Maybe I could have cleaned up my act a little bit, but it was mainly looking like I belonged at a university instead of at a business in town. It was subtle, but it was enough to get me a job. And I walked into the classroom on the first day, and it was like the room was like the final medal awarding scene in Star Wars. It was huge, light-filled windows and wood. You know, UC Santa Cruz is built out of redwood and cedar and, you know, beautiful glowing wood and huge amounts of glass and lots of light. And it's like at that time, it was like a fairyland.
And
it was like a dream, an abstract dream of what an educational environment would be.
Well, just to be clear, did you already have a college degree at this point?
I had an undergraduate degree, yeah.
So you had to go to graduate school in order to be a TA?
You would have to go. Normally, you would have to go to graduate school to be a TA. But they had this category. They didn't officially call it mercenary, but that's what it was. They were hiring grunts off the street as a temporary measure until they could raise up a generation or two of graduate students. They didn't yet have enough at the grad level. UC was too young. The Santa Cruz campus was not yet mature enough to have enough grad students to go around. So I hit them at that moment.
And this was a class that Donna Haraway was teaching?
No, it was being taught by a woman named Maria, I can't remember her.
Oh, that's okay.
Film history. It was a course in film history.
Oh, great.
The professor was also very young. UC was hiring very young people to tenure track lines at that point. And I was gobsmacked by the whole idea that the only thing we were there to do was to teach people. I had never really gotten the concept before. And it was a combination of the fact that we were doing it in this Star Trek fairyland atmosphere, this kind of Frankish, Lloyd Wrightish miracle room, and with young, enthusiastic professors and students who were there because they were almost handpicked to be the best and the brightest. That was one of the differences when I first came to the University of Texas that I had to get used to. I didn't realize what an elitist situation I had fallen into, you know, where everybody had a 4.0 average.
And a lot of academic politics. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, let's not even go there.
So did you enroll at UC Santa Cruz to get your graduate degree? Enroll at UC Santa Cruz as a result of?
I enrolled three times. I got rejected twice. I didn't enroll for a while. I went on being a mercenary. But the more I did it, the more I began to sink into it, into the academic milieu, which at that time was this very idealistic University of California, Santa Cruz, initial build out atmosphere. I mean, it was like, it was a Veldon showing. You can't imagine. It was a magical place, and it will not be that way again. And I was thrown into the middle of it. I was precipitated into this singularity in time and space anyway.
So,
and one day I found myself on back campus walking from one class. Oh, I went out and got every teaching assignment I could get. I think at that point I was teaching three or four, because not being a graduate student meant there was no limit on how many I could do. And I wasn't there for very long before I was in demand. So I was teaching in music, in world history, in the history of consciousness courses, in music in film history, and I don't know. Anyway, I was doing a lot of it.
The guerrilla academic.
Yeah, I met exactly that suited me, and I was meeting wonderful, interesting professors, and who I much later discovered had been in awe of me and were looking to me for some kind of idea of how to move in that situation. I had no idea that was happening. I was looking to them. We were the blind leading the blind. They were the professors. Show me what to do now.
So when you finally enrolled, what was your course of study, your major?
Well, I was fascinated with what Donna was doing and with what Jim Clifford was doing. And I was just discovering what Hayden White was doing in narratology. And so I applied to HISCOM. It was perfect for me because it didn't require you to elect any of the traditional disciplines. You could design your own program, providing that you could enroll some of their professors in your cause. So that was difficult, but not impossible. The main thing about it as well. All right. First, I and another wild genius friend of mine proposed a joint PhD in delateralization. You know, this was the time when third wave feminism was just getting going. Adrienne Rich had just written The Dream of a Common Language. There was a huge amount of fire and activity going on in feminism. And the idea that that lateralization of the brain could have something to do with patriarchy was a plausibility, at least at that point. And we proposed a dissertation based on that idea. And I didn't understand enough of how academia worked. And the proposal I wrote was largely gobbledygook. It had the right ideas, but not in the right way. It wasn't logically laid out enough. It did not use academic jargon properly. I didn't make myself intelligible to the other people. And they rejected me. And I heard later they laughed at the proposal. So I spent another year being a mercenary. And then I applied again with a different topic alone, and not with a partner, which they said made it much harder. They said it was much harder applying with a partner, that I should apply alone. I did that. I got rejected again. But this time there was no laughter. And after a while, I met one of the professors in the department who said to me, here's what you have to do to get in. I mean, I think you've got the stuff, but it's not enough to have the stuff. You have to make yourself intelligible to us. You've got to be non-threatening. I mean, there are people here who are afraid of you. You're too bright for the kind of things that you're talking about. So here's what you need to do. You go to parties. Whenever somebody throws a party in the apartment, go to that party. Just be nice. You know, get to know people. Have a drink with them. Learn the language. Learn the lingo. And then try again. And then a couple of the graduate students came to me and very quietly, you know, and they said, you want to know how to talk theory? We'll show you how to talk theory. And then I got a lesson in how to talk theory. And it opened my eyes. Oh, this is what you're talking about. So after another several months of that, you know, meeting people, being inoffensive and innocuous, but being present, being visible, being non-threatening, I wrote another application that was based on the idea that that computer interaction could be treated as a discourse, and that it was a legitimate topic of academic discussion, which at that time it was not. You know, UC had a mainframe somewhere, but that was the extent of it. And I did. I wrote that one, and I bit my nails for a while, and they accepted me. And that was the beginning of a few weeks after that, I found myself on that campus with an armful of books, going from one class I was teaching to another, and then to one that I was taking. And I had a vision. I had an honest-to-God vision. I'm not talking metaphorically. I had a vision in which I saw my life pass before me like a circus train. And each car was painted as a different career that I'd had in my life. And they went by, you know, the computer person, the performance person, I don't know, you know, all of those things, the recording engineer, the fiction writer, on and on. And when the caboose went by, there was a clown standing on the little platform on the back of the caboose with a red nose. And as that went by, the clown waved at me. And I waved back. And I said, bye-bye, bye-bye to my previous life. This is my new life now. And the train went off into the distance and disappeared. And I was an academic. That was my moment. And I never looked back. It was, for me, it's hard for me to relate how academia worked for me, as opposed to anyone else I've ever met. But for me, it was entering the gates of paradise. And I eventually had to confront the real world when I went out to get a job. And then I got, you know, I got my share of the marriage of heaven and hell. And I got the hell part. And that was okay too, because out of that fusion came some very interesting and creative stuff.
So what was the hell part?
That's my story.
What was the hell part? I mean, what?
The University of Texas at Austin is one of the foremost academic institutions in the world. They have some wonderful people there. I came to the wrong department, but I'm forever grateful to them for letting me in the first place.
And well, you did something that they would never have done, you know, without you there. I mean, that was completely you, the ACT Lab.
Well, you have to admit that they asked for something and gritted their teeth for the consequences, but they weren't quite. When I was hired, the chair specifically said to me, "We're bringing you here to drag the department kicking and screaming into the 21st century." And I was there for 20 years. I dragged them kicking and screaming the whole time. Eventually, I got them into the 19th century, and I was
That sounds like UT.
Well, there are a lot of good people in my department, a lot of very smart people. But the people who ran the department, and this is one of the ways that academia works. Frequently, the people who rise administratively are people who are there because they're willing to carry out agendas that that nobody else likes.
Well, is it safe to say that part of your problem at the University of Texas was that they just didn't understand you, didn't understand what you were doing, the people that you actually had to report to?
I think the main thing about being there was that the people whom I had to report to not only didn't understand what I was doing, but didn't want it. And from their point of view, that was perfectly reasonable. In the first place, nobody knew what new media was. But whatever it was, it had to involve getting a lot of people jobs. And demonstrating you could get somebody a job in new media was not possible because new media didn't exist. And consequently, there were no jobs out there for it. But the program that I built got people jobs anywhere by virtue of teaching them how to not be specialists, but be generalists and do the dance.
I mean, I've known a lot of the people who were at ACT Lab over the years, and I don't think anybody didn't land on their feet.
Well, it wasn't that it was hard to demonstrate. It was that the administration had an agenda. And in fact, there were things going on that I didn't know about because they refused to tell me. And that if they had told me, things would have been, I think, somewhat different. But partly during the entire time I was there, there was a dean off in the background somewhere trying to raise money for whatever their vision of the department was. And what I was doing didn't necessarily fit into that, particularly when another dean came in and wanted to build a serious, you know, new media complex according to his definitions of what that meant, which had a lot to do with journalism and very, very little to do with anything else, and was courting multimillionaires and the likely Texas people he's likely to find with gobs and gobs of money are going to be ultra conservative, evangelical Christian types of people for whom my very existence was an anathema.
Yeah, so, a real challenge to their thinking.
Yeah, well, not just my thinking about new media, but as it turned out, the fact that I was trans, that were, they needed to keep me out of sight lest I upset any apple carts. And it was not that there was any organized transphobic thing going on at high levels at UT. That was not happening. In fact, I was on a number of committees who were asked by the upper administration to develop protocols by which incoming students would be able to choose names other than their birth names for the official UT records. That's a really advanced thing for when I was there in the 90s. And that, by the way, was a very, very difficult task. They didn't get to deploy it for a long, long time because of what it means for the computer systems that they had in place, which didn't have any way to do that. It meant a lot of software rewriting and anyway, big mess. But that was going on.
But we have kind of reached the end of our hour.
Oh, thank God.
And I think there's a lot more that we could have discussed. So I'm hoping you'll come back and we can, in a couple of months, do a follow-up.
Yeah, we have a lot more hours that we can fill. So you're more than welcome to take as many as you like.
We can do it if you guys like. I'll be glad to do it.
You can follow the Plutopia News Network at plutopia.io. On Facebook, go to @PlutopiaNews. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. With John Lepkoski, I'm Scoop Sweeney. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.